bits to one bit. But maybe it's not so trivial, because there are all sorts of different interpretations that you can have for a particular Boolean function. And I'm just going to sort of give a couple of examples of the board of several interpretations of the same function. So like the natural way, maybe if you're an electronic engineer or a computer scientist, to interpret a Boolean function is by its truth table. Like, for example, you might have some function of x1, x2 that looks like this. Okay, so that defines a Boolean function in two bits. So that all seems very simple. But you could also interpret this, for example, like if we index these things just in a natural way as like integers between 0, 1, 2, and 3, then we can see this as subset 1, 2. So this function defines a subset. Or if we look at it another way, we can consider this function as defining a subset of the power set of, say, x1, x2, or sort of the subset, for example. You see it as defining that set. It's pretty obvious. You can also see this as a coloring of the n-dimensional cube. Sort of taking a more applicable viewpoint, you can also see this thing as a voting system. Where these things, x1 and x2, are voters, and this function combines their votes somehow to give you the overall will of the people, if you like. This is a bit of a bizarre voting rule, but nevertheless, it's a voting rule. Or again, taking another maybe more applied interpretation, you can see this thing as the decision tree. Like you can see, for example, one way one decision tree that computes this function would be query x1, and if it's 0. Okay, so the internal nodes say the variables we're querying, and then the leaves here say what the output of the function is. So this is a decision tree that computes this function. So basically, and there are lots of other interpretations of Boolean functions. So basically, what this means is that anything that we can say about Boolean functions in all generality will apply to all of these different objects, which maybe don't seem so related at first sight. And if we can say something interesting, then maybe it'll translate into something interesting to, about all of these things. So maybe it's worth trying to understand what we can say about these things. Okay, so what sort of questions might we want to ask about Boolean functions? We might want to know which functions are extremal in some sense. So we could imagine, say, we're designing a voting scheme. We might want to design the best voting scheme. Like, maybe I want to design the voting scheme that's somehow fairest to the voters for some definition of fair, or is the least sensitive to noise. So let's imagine each voter makes a mistake with some probability in pressing a button for what their vote is. We might want to minimize the chance that this leads to the overall result of the election being wrong. So we might want to analyze the extremal properties of these things. Or we might want to, for example, say how complex is a particular function or some particular class of functions. Like, sort of question we might want to ask computer science, but we generally can't answer, is how complex is the smallest circuit for computing a function, which is impossibly difficult. But we might be able to answer things like how small is the smallest decision tree for computing a function, how hard is it to learn this function, so given access to it as an oracle, can we approximately learn what the function is? And there are various other complexity measures we might want to consider. And there are lots of other questions we might want to ask. And the field of the analysis of Boolean functions aims to answer questions like this. So what's a nice, easy way to sum up this field? There's a lovely set of lecture notes by Ryan O'Donnell at CMU for an entire lecture course on the analysis of Boolean functions. He sums up what this field is as basically getting information about Boolean functions by looking at their Fourier spectrum, or Fourier expansion. The first bit of my talk, I'm going to define what this is and sort of maybe give some examples where this lets you do interesting things. Okay. So what's it mean to do Fourier analysis of Boolean functions? Well, we want to look at the group Z2 to the n to start with. So this is, you can think that it's just a group of n bits. So what's Fourier analysis of this group? Well, we want to expand functions like that f up there to, from the n bits to the reals in terms of the characters of the group Z2 to the N. And these characters have a very simple interpretation. They're just these so-called parity functions. So this thing is the parity of x1 and x2. And in general, you can define the parity function chi s of x as just the minus 1 to the sum of the bits in x in s. So s here is a subset of the integers from 1 to n. And this just indexes the bits that you care about in this term of this parity function. Okay, and you can show, so each of these chi s's is a function of x. So it's a function from 0 from 1 to the n to the reals. And you can show that, it's pretty straightforward to show that any function f, as defined up there, has some expansion in terms of these parity functions. And the coefficients that you get in this expansion, we just say they're the Fourier coefficients of the function f.
Plus and minus one instead of
So the values of the function, I mean, at this point, the values of the function could be anything. Like, I mean, this is not just Boolean functions. So, I guess it raises a good point that a lot of the time it's more natural to think of these Boolean functions as being functions like, like that, or maybe even, minus, like that. But I'm trying to avoid these issues in this talk, and I'm just going to use the 0, 1 to the end notation throughout. Okay, so, so any function from this Boolean cube to the reals can be expanded in terms of these functions. How do we find what these Fourier coefficients are? Well, I mean, it's pretty much already obvious from the slide, but it's particularly nice for people who like quantum information theory, because to find these things, we just need to do the Fourier transform over Z2 to the N, which is just a renormalization of the Hadamard transform. So if we think of this putative function f as in 2 to the N dimensional vector, then to find the Fourier coefficients, we a vector written in a sort of natural order, if you like, then the Fourier coefficients are literally just apply a Hadamard gate to each qubit, if you like, and renormalize the thing. And this gives you this vector of Fourier coefficients. So once we have this notion of the Fourier expansion of Boolean function, then we can already get an idea of some notion of complexity of functions. So we define the degree of a function as simply the largest, the size of the largest subset, such that Fourier coefficient of that subset is non-zero. So for example, this function I defined here, because this is just equal to the parity of these two bits, then its degree is 2, because it's, this function is just the same as the parity function. So degree of that's 2, and in general, gets a function, it's the degree of any particular function. And the intuition is that if the function is high degree, then it's complex. What's the intuition behind this intuition? If we think about the functions from the reals to the reals, and then any function, these are just reals. Any such function could be expanded in terms of it's traditional Fourier expansion, trigonometric powers of trigonometric functions. The intuition is that a function like this seems more complex than a function. Maybe I should have made this one a bit more clear. Something like that. If this seems more complex than this, and probably this will have a more complicated Fourier expansion than this. So somehow the intuition is that higher degree functions are spikier and more complex, and they'll be.
Is there a reason why you're using a different normalization on the Hadamard matrix?
Yes. In this, thinking about Boolean functions, it turns out to be a bit more natural. If you have a function which just takes the values plus or minus 1, then if you look at its Fourier transform, then the sum of the squares of this Fourier transform is going to be 1. So this is rather than square root 2 to the n, which it would be if you normalize this.
I just wanted to comment on your this connection between the spikes and the degree.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't quite agree, actually.
Okay.
For example, the threshold function, right, the majority function, it's just like a step.
Mm-hmm.
And so has no spikes but has degree n.
Sure. So I guess I wasn't agreeing. Sorry?
Same with the delta function.
So maybe it is especially good intuition. I guess my spike is too vague to make much sense. So yeah, let's forget that. So that's the very basics of Fourier analysis and Boolean cube. So what can we do with this Fourier analysis? Okay, we're going to start out talking a little bit about property testing of Boolean functions. Okay, so we say that two Boolean functions f and g are epsilon close if the probability that they differ is equal to epsilon. I'm assuming this is the uniform distribution on the input. So whenever I say probability, it's always the uniform distribution of the epsilon. This means that there are epsilon times 2 to the n places where these functions differ. The sort of problem we want to solve for this property testing is given access to some Boolean function f as an oracle, so just query it and get some input and get the answer to black box, then you want to find a test that uses this function some constant number of times, outputs true with certainty if f has some property, which the test will depend on what property we're interested in, and outputs false with probability at least delta if f is delta close to having some property. What's this mean? So this thing is going to be like a randomized test. It will sort of query the function at some positions given by some randomization. And the idea is that with even a constant number, so maybe even like 2, 3, 4 queries to this function, if this function, we can tell whether the function has some property or it's far away from having some property. It's kind of intuitive that a constant number of queries, we can't distinguish between the place where a function has some property and it's very close to having some property. Because it seems like we'd need to know most of what the function does everywhere. So this is kind of intuitively, I'm not justifying this, the best we can do with a constant number of queries. Maybe there aren't any interesting properties where we can do this, but it turns out that there are. For example, we might want to tell if this function f is linear. So that is that f of x plus y is equal to f of x plus f of y for all y. This turns out to be exactly the same as saying that f is a parity function. So f is the parity of bits in some subset s. And another interesting property that we want to think about is whether f only depends on one of its inputs. So we say that f is a dictator in this situation. All right, so these property testers are sort of useful ingredients in various results in theoretical computer science that I guess I won't go into. Second area that we might want to think about is related to this Fourier expansion is what can we say about the Fourier expansion of a Boolean function or some kind of structural property of it? Because it seems like these functions have really quite weak structure. Because the only constraint is that they take the value 0 or 1. Can we say sort of generic things about what does the Fourier expansion of such a function look like? It turns out that there are sort of general principles that we can come up with in this area. One of these is that we can say that Boolean functions, the Fourier expansion has this heavy tail, if you like. there's a couple of theorems I'm going to mention in this area. The first is this so-called Friedgut-Kallein-Nauer theorem. It says that if the sum of the squares of the Fourier coefficients of a Boolean function, excluding the first level of this, so this is the sum of the squares of the Fourier coefficients over all subsets that have more than one element in, if that's very small, if it's less than epsilon, then this function's close to being a dictator, so close to only depending on one variable. So this means that if we can say something about the Fourier expansion of Boolean function, we can say something about how close it is to a dictator. And sort of a stronger principle, like is this theorem of Bourgain, which is that if the sum of the squares of the Fourier coefficients on subsets of so bigger than size k, so like large subsets, is small, is that less than 1 over square root of k near enough, then f's close to depending on only k variables, which we call a k-hunter. These are, I don't know, maybe a little surprising, because it says that you can say something about the Fourier spectrum only based on this constraint that these functions are Boolean. And these results have actually turned out to be useful. The Friedgut-Kallein-Nauer theorem has been used in the theory of social choice, so understanding kind of voting schemes. And also they've both been used in results to do with the hardness of approximation of NP-complete problems. And the final sort of third application that I'll just mention is computational learning theory. The idea is that we're given oracle access to some Boolean function f, which is promised to have some kind of property. So, for example, we're promised that maybe it's low degree, or maybe it's kind of sparse, or maybe it doesn't depend on very many variables, or something like that. And we're asked to output some approximation to f that's close to it in some sense. So what I mean by this is a function which agrees with f on most of its inputs. So if we want to actually output what f is exactly, then we're going to need, and we say we don't have any a priori information about what f is, then we'd expect that we need about 2 to the n queries to f. We need to basically query what it does on every input, and then we can write down its truth table. But it turns out that you can use ideas from Fourier analysis sometimes to get much better kind of approximate learning results. The basic idea is that if we can approximate the Fourier transform of some function f, then we can approximate f. I'm not saying anything quantitative just yet. It turns out that you can estimate what an individual Fourier coefficient of f is efficiently. Avoiding all sorts of other issues, but if there aren't too many Fourier coefficients of f, so if f's Fourier transform is sparse, then it seems that we might be able to estimate the function itself efficiently. I'm going to maybe be a little more specific about this later, but an important extension of this kind of idea is this Goldreich-Levin algorithm, which outputs a list of the Fourier coefficients of some function f that are large efficiently, where what these quotes mean is that how the running time of the algorithm depends on the size of the Fourier coefficients that you're interested in. So as you are interested in smaller and smaller ones, then the running time of the algorithm increases. And if you want to output all of the Fourier coefficients of f and you want to do it exactly, then it's no more efficient than just querying f all of its possible inputs and just writing down the f's truth table. For example, let's say we're promised that f doesn't have very many Fourier coefficients, then we can use this algorithm to output an approximation to f efficiently. And it turns out that sometimes you can prove things about the Fourier transform of f just by saying that f is in some class. Like, for example, if you happen to know that f is computed by a shallow decision tree, then you know that it can't have too many Fourier coefficients. So this algorithm or similar algorithms could work efficiently. So that's pretty much it for the motivational stuff about the classical world. So now I'm going to be talking about quantum generalizations of some of these results. Okay, so in order to generalize these results, the first thing we need is the basic concept of what a quantum Boolean function is. And it's an extremely simple definition. It's just an operator on n qubits that squares the identity. So this is this is an extremely simple definition. I'm going to use the term QBF for the rest of the talk. Apologies for the acronym. The rest of this talk, I'm basically going to be talking about some basic consequences of what this definition means. And then I'm going to be talking about some generalizations of these classical results in these areas that I've just mentioned to the world of quantum Boolean functions. Let's take some sanity checks of this definition. So the thing about classical Boolean functions is you can compute them using circuits, right? So the first thing we might want to do is to compute for the quantum Boolean function is to compute it using a quantum circuit. And this is kind of immediate. Quantum Boolean function is a unitary operator. In fact, they're also Hermitian because all of their eigenvalues are plus or minus one. So that's immediate. So, of course, this quantum circuit might not be efficient, but still. Second sanity check. Is this concept of quantum Boolean function actually a generalization of classical Boolean functions? Because you'd certainly hope it was being quantum. It is. Again, this is pretty easy. Given any classical Boolean function, f is defined up there, there are at least two natural ways that you could implement f on a quantum computer, which are very well known. First is this bit oracle that has an input and output register, x and y, where y is one bit and x is n bits, and simply maps x and y to x and y plus f of x, where that's modulo 2. Where you might want to implement Boolean function is by this so-called phase oracle, where you just put the value of the function in the phase of the input. It's pretty easy to see, it's kind of immediate in the second case, and it's pretty easy to show in the first case that these oracle things both give you quantum Boolean functions. So this really is a generalization of a classical Boolean function. Okay, but if all we had were classical Boolean functions that end, then this would be a pretty boring definition. But it turns out that there are lots of other examples of quantum Boolean functions which are quite simple to get. If you have a projector, so operator P, such as P squared is equal to P, then this immediately gives you a quantum Boolean function by just taking the function being identity minus twice times this projector. We have any quantum algorithm that solves a decision problem gives you a quantum Boolean function. So why is this? Because you imagine a quantum algorithm consisting of a quantum circuit that you run on some input, and then you measure one of the qubits to get the answer at 0 or 1. And this is just a decomposition of the overall Hilbert space into a 0 subspace and a 1 subspace. So this gives you a quantum Boolean function. Any quantum error correcting code, for example, that's subspace. So this, again, gives you, by this subtracting twice the projector from the identity, this gives you a quantum Boolean function as well. Obviously, there are lots of other places where subspaces appear, which might also be interesting. Okay, so how many are there of these things? Well, again, this is maybe obvious, but I'm just going to state it. There are uncountably many of these things. So even on one qubit, we have this operator f for any theta. This is a quantum Boolean function. This compares with the classical world where we only have four Boolean functions on one bit. So this maybe suggests that the theory might be a little more complicated. Okay. There are various other examples that you can think up for yourselves. For the rest of the talk, I'm going to need some definitions, which I'm going to inflict on you now. These are to do with norms and inner products, and this is all going to be relevant for our ideas of generalizing Fourier analysis to the quantum Boolean function world. The first definition we'll need is a normalized Schatten p-norm. For any d-dimensional operator, we define this p-norm as the average of the singular values to the p-th power then the whole thing taking to the 1 over p power. So note that in quantum information theory, normally we don't normalize this thing, and so this 1 over d wouldn't be here. But this will turn out to be a little more natural for the sort of things that we want to do. But be careful, because it's easy to caught out with that. Immediately, it's quite easy to see that if f is a quantum Boolean function, so f is an operator at n qubits that squares the identity, then all of its p norms are 1, this definition, which is one reason why we're using this definition. Okay, so note that with this non-standard normalization, that this thing is not a submultiplicative matrix norm like the Schaffner p norm normally is, apart from at p equals infinity. And also, the order of norm inequalities is reversed from what it would be normally. So as p increases, then the norm increases, rather than the other way around, which would be if we change the normalization.
Mm-hmm. Why is it 1 for Boolean functions? Like, if it's odd, then won't you get some minus 1s?
All of the eigenvalues are plus or minus 1. The singular values are all 1.
I see.
So, okay, right. Okay. So we're also going on with this norm. We're also going to use that normalized Hilbert-Schmidt inner product on the space of d-dimensional operators.
I'm just thinking about what your quantum Boolean function looks like. For unitary operators, they're basically a permission, right? And with eigenvalues plus minus 1, mm-hmm. which corresponds directly to a classical Boolean function, right? Because in some basis, that's the only.
Yes, exactly. So, right. If your question is going to be, isn't this just a trivial extension of the.
How it's going.
I guess I should say that if all you needed to do was, so in some basis this thing just looks like a classical Boolean function, this is true, but it will turn out some of the results later that basis will very much matter, so you can't just change the basis and use the classical result to show what you want to.
So another comment actually, so that it generalizes also to non-unitary operations. Just by looking at, so you have this operator which is basically its own inverse, right?
Yes.
And that can be characterized in a similar fashion, and it's basically given by, just attaching an ancilla and then doing a unitary operator on the entire state. Actually, a little bit more than that, maybe just that. I forget.
I guess you could. So in some ways we've just picked this like the simplest generalization that we can think of.
I mean is that your definition itself implies that the operation is of a certain form, which is how I describe it.
Yes, sure.
And then it reduces again to this Hermitian case.
Yes. So,
just wanted to point that out.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, so we're going to be using this normalized Hilbert-Schmidt product, which we're going to write as these angle brackets here. First thing to note is that for these definitions of norms and the products, we have matrix version of Holder's inequality. So for 1 over p plus 1 over q is equal to 1, then the inner product, the absolute value of the inner product of f and g is less than or equal to be a product of their p and q norms. This is kind of a non-trivial thing, you can prove it. This holds even though the submultiplicative property doesn't hold, which is kind of nice. So far I guess I should stress that everything I'm talking about in this slide is all kind of well known, but maybe this interpretation, presentation bit is kind of a little different to usual. Okay, so the first thing we want to do to analyze these quantibillion functions is to find an analog of Fourier analysis over Z2 to the n. Okay. And for us, the natural analog of the characters of Z2 are going to be the Pauli matrices. So we're going to write these as sigma 0, sigma 1, sigma 2, and sigma 3. And then just define that, as I'm sure you all know. These are all quantibillion functions because they're eigenmodes at 1 minus 1. It's the identity, which is 1 and 1. We're going to write an intensive product of Pauli's, which we're going to just call a stabilizer operator, as chi s, where this s is supposed to be bold, but you probably can't see it. This is by analogy with the classical characters of Z2 to the n. And this thing is just defined as a tensor product of, So S here we think of as a string of integers between 0 and 3. The string tells you which Pauli operator you have at each site. So this is pretty natural. And we're also going to use the notation of sigma subscripts I superscript j for the dictator, what we're going to call a dictator, which is just sigma j at the ith position, and that's trivially elsewhere, so the identity everywhere else.
So is the classical analog, sorry for interrupting, but is the classical analog when you just have the sigma 3 in a sense?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, precisely.
Okay.
This is all well-known stuff, but these operators, these 4 to the n operators that we have here, chi s operators, form an orthonormal basis for the, under this normalized Hilbert Schmidt in the product, for the space of operators on n qubits. So this implies, for example, that any n qubits operator f has an expansion in terms of these stabilizer operators. And for Hermitian operators f, then these coefficients are real. These coefficients are defined by just taking the inner product, the Hilbert Schmidt inner product of this operator f and this particular stabilizer operator you're interested in. Okay, so this is going to be our analog of the Fourier expansion. And this orthonormality also gives us analogs of Plancherel's theorem of particles equality for standard Fourier analysis. If we have f and g are Hermitian operators on n qubits, then their inner product is just the, if you like, the inner product of their Fourier expansions, the sum of products of their Fourier coefficients. In particular, this implies that the squared 2 norm of a Hermitian operator f is equal to the sum of the squares of the of its Fourier coefficients. I probably should call these things Fourier coefficients, but I won't be able to stop myself. If f's a quantibillion function, we have the sum of the squares of its Fourier coefficients is 1. And this is kind of the first pretty trivial, but maybe not completely obvious thing we can say about the Fourier structure of a quantibillion function. Now we have a quantum analog of this Fourier expansion. We can try and generalize some of these classical results that depend on Fourier analysis. So what results do we get? I'll just list them. We find some, our results include a quantum property testers that tell you with a small number of uses of an unknown quantum Boolean function whether it's close to having some property. We have quantum analogs of computational learning results. In particular, we have a quantum algorithm that outputs the large Fourier coefficients of an unknown quantum Boolean function, which we access as an oracle. So this allows us to maybe approximate this, quantum Boolean function. Quantum analog of this Friedrich Kalai-Naur theorem, which tells you something about the Fourier expansion of quantum Boolean functions. Okay, and in order to get this last result, we prove a quantum version of a so-called hypercontractive inequality, classically, and this might be of independent interest. So let's go into a little more detail. So we want to solve problems like this. Given access to some quantum Boolean functions promised to either have some property or to be far from having some property, determine which of these two cases is the case with a small number of uses of this this operator. Okay, so the first thing we need to do to make it a little more rigorous is to define a notion of closeness for quantum Boolean functions. So if we have two quantum Boolean functions f and g, we say that they're epsilon close if their inner product is at least 1 minus 2 epsilon. Equivalently, in terms of their we have equivalent statement in terms of the distance in the two norm. Quantum information theory, people can also think of the operator normal, other norms, but using this norm will give us the kind of average case rather than worst case notion of closeness, which may or may not be to your taste. Okay. So, here's a representative example of the sort of problems we can solve. So given access to an unknown quantum Boolean function, f, determine whether it's a stabilizer operator, chi s, for some s, some string s. So this is a generalization of classical linearity testing, because as Richard says, the classical linear functions are just the parity functions, which we can think of as just the operators chi s, where s only contains zeros or threes, so it's only Pauli z's and identities. We have a test for this property, which is called quantum stabilizer test, which has the following property. So if it uses two queries to this operator. Suppose that some quantum Boolean function passes this test with probability 1 minus epsilon. So we say that, yes, it is a stabilizer. Then that means that it is actually epsilon close to being a stabilizer. So this test, you know, allows you to solve problems like, you know, if someone gives you an operator and promises you it's a stabilizer operator, maybe you don't believe them, so you run this test, and after a couple of uses of it, you can be fairly confident that it is. And this beats the best known classical test, in fact, which uses three queries to determine linearity. Is it
exactly analogous to the classical test? Because when you were describing this, which you tested in the classical case, you had to pass the test with certainty.
I summarize this. So our test, you will pass with certainty if you are a stabilizer operator. I just was a bit overly brief on this slide. Our test is defined such that if f is a stabilizer operator, it passes with certainty. We would definitely say it's a stabilizer operator. And if it passes with some probability close to 1, then that means it's close to things. So I'm just going to kind of sketch what our algorithm is, and then talk about the analysis a little. Our algorithm is pretty straightforward. We apply this unknown operator f to halves of n maximally entangled states, we imagine that we have n qubits down here, and they're all n maximally entangled states, and we apply f to this.
In your notation, you're already assuming that f is unitary, just by. On that slide itself, the second line where you say cat f equals.
Yes. I'm sorry, I don't understand.
So, you know, in your definition, and there's a characterization theorem which I mentioned earlier. In your definition, f could be an operation that mixes pure states, for example. I mean, it could map pure states to mixed states, right? Whereas, I mean, just by writing it as ket f equals f.
So,
Okay. Let's just
say what about it?
Well,
I think it was defined exactly on the Hilbert space.
I'm sorry?
It was defined exactly on the Hilbert space, if I'm not mistaken. So
it is, but this
so
is...
It can't code a mixed state, so it always goes to pure state. The question is whether it's unitary or not.
It is, I mean, that's what I claim. But it wasn't. I'm saying that it's significant because you're assuming that it's unitary.
Wasn't it defined unitary?
Not quite. I mean,
I guess I mean, I assume it was a quantum operator.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
it's always
a unitary operator.
Okay. Actually, even if it weren't, there's a theorem which it says that it's a Hermitian unitary operator, given that, you know, it squares to the identity.
I
misunderstood your definition. I thought it was a QVF is a general quantum operation which squares to. It actually turns out to be equivalent to yours. So everything is fine.
Okay. Okay. Right. So let's see. So if this operator that we just applied is actually a stabilizer operator, then this thing should be a tensor product of it should be completely stackable. It should be a tensor product of one of four possible states at each position, which corresponds to which how the operator is at each position. And if it's not, then there's going to be some kind of entanglement going on between the systems. That's not quite right. I shouldn't say that. But let's forget that. So what we're going to do, we're going to create two copies of this state. So we have this, and another one here. Okay, and again, we've applied F to this half, and we've applied F to this half. Okay. We're going to perform a joint measurement on each of these pairs of entangled states. Each one, like this. That's the bottom. And this measurement will try and determine if these things are both produced by the same Pauli operator on that state. So this will just be a sum of projectors onto the states that we would expect to get for each Pauli operator. And our test simply accepts if all of the measurements say yes.
Sorry, the next last step. Basically, you just want to see if they're the same Bell state.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Exactly. Okay. So. So that test seems pretty simple. It seems like it might work, but how do we calculate the probability of correctness? I won't go into the derivation here, but it turns out that the probability of this thing accepting is the sum of the fourth powers of the Fourier coefficients of this operator F. This is very similar to the analysis of the classical linearity test, by the way. Because of particle duration, we know that the sum of the squares of the Fourier coefficients is 1. So given that this test, assuming that this test passes with probability 1 minus epsilon, then the sum of the fourth powers of the Fourier coefficients is at least 1 minus epsilon. So this inequality holds. So this means that the maximum square of the Fourier coefficient is at least 1 minus epsilon. That means that we have one big term which is bigger than 1 minus epsilon. So this means that this operator F is epsilon close to a stabilizer operator, and which stabilizer operator is will be obviously given by this S. Okay, so this sketches the proof that this test works.
Did you say what the joint measurement was?
Okay, I guess I didn't write it down. So basically, this joint measurement is just the so we have an individual measurement of each of the n pairs, if you like, and this is just the I don't know what the best way to write this, but it's just the sum. Can you see this behind me?
But not beyond the.
Well, let's get that fixed. So, same then. Sigma S times by the Maxwellian tangle. So basically, we're just saying that all this operator is trying, all this measurement is trying to do is say, is the state here and the state here produced by the same power operator?
I mean, you can just actually measure what the power operator is, right? You don't have to really
be sure. Yeah, you could do that. What you can do is you can just measure each. Maybe that's less confusing than presenting it. You can measure each of these things and then do the whole thing again and see if you get the same answer each time. Okay. So there's another property we might want to test, which is another type of generalization of the classical linearity test, which is locality. The idea behind this is that if we're given access to some unknown operator f, we want to find out if this is a tensor product of local unit trees. So u1 through to un, where each of these is like a single qubit.
Does this give
u
a tensor product?
This will give you an improved quantum test for classical linearity. So but you save like one query, so whether this is interesting, I don't know. I think the classical test would probably be provably optimal for classical computers.
Basically, if you only test in two places,
it seems that you
really possibly tell what it is.
Yeah.
But there's a quantum test that only makes one query.
Really? So it seems like whichever quantum measurement you do, I don't know if you can infer a different quantum measurement. But, we have a test which we think may solve this problem, but we don't know how to analyze its probability of success. It's kind of a typical thing in classical property testing that tests are very simple, and analyzing their probability of success is quite hard. So basically, we have this conjecture, and if any of you can solve it, then this would be quite interesting. I've stated it in kind of vague terms. If we let rho be some quantum state on n qubits, such that the average over all possible tracings out of subsystems of the purity of the reduced density matrix is high, then the conjecture is that this is quantum state rho is close to being a product state. Well, because we don't really know what the right answer is, I haven't put anything more specific in there. So you can see that if rho is a product state over product of n single qubit states, then this thing's always going to be the answer of this thing's going to be one. But the conjecture is that if it's close to being one, then rho is close to being a product state. But we don't even really properly know how to formulate this conjecture. So I previously mentioned dictator testing, we have, similarly to this two different variants of linearity testing, we have two variants of dictator testing. We have a test for one, which is basically saying, is this operator a stabilizer operator which only acts on a single qubit non-trivially? But we don't have a test. Well, we have a test that we can't analyze for the thing that you might be more interested in, which is this operator a unitary which only acts on a single qubit and acts trivially elsewhere?
This to the hardness results for checking separability. So are these consistent with your...
checking what, sir?
Just determining whether a given state is, it's a different problem.
Okay.
I guess the hardness results hold. I mean, I don't know whether you know what Gurwitz...
Only tangentially, so...
It's a different problem there. You're given the description of the states. Mm-hmm. And so it's, it's not a...
Okay, so... Right, let's see the properties. I'm way running out of time, so I'm...
So when you're given a description of the states, it's only an easier problem than this one, right? Where you're given the quantum state.
And then the
value testing problem?
Right.
You're given the
oracle. I understand, but even the second one, so if you look at
the second one, you're not given any.
Yeah, I mean, this basically, this, if this conjecture is true, then we have a test for this locality testing problem, which, depending on what the answer is, it's either works or doesn't.
In particular, if you start with, let's say, the all zero state and use your oracle to produce a...
That's
misunderstood again.
Okay, so, as I said, I'm kind of running a bit over, so I'm going to just talk a little bit about hypercontractivity and quantum free-loop power now, and then I think I'll stop. In classical analysis of Boolean functions, many of the interesting results depend crucially on this so-called hypercontractive inequality, which is of Bonamy, Gross, and Beckner, and also several other people have independently proven variants. This inequality allows us to prove results like every Boolean function which has about half zero, it takes zero on about half its inputs, has an influential variable. I haven't defined it for influential, but basically you can imagine this as a voter which has the ability to swing the election more than you might want. This inequality also allows us to prove the Sprigot-Naur-Kalai-Naur theorem and Gauguin's theorem and various other things. So we're going to be talking about a quantum generalization of this inequality, which we use to prove some results in quantum Boolean functions. So first I should define what a classical inequality is. And it's most easily defined in terms of this so-called noise operator, which you can think of as like a local smoothing operator. We're going to define the distribution on bit strings, where we say that for a given bit string X, Y is a sort of a noisy version of X. We say that Y is the output of Y is the same as the output of X, the probability of half plus epsilon over 2, and it's the difference to the output of X with probability half minus epsilon over 2. So you can see that epsilon goes between, you can imagine epsilon going between 0 and 1, and when epsilon is equal to 1, then y is just the same as x, and when epsilon is equal to 0, then y is completely random. We can define a noise operator using this distribution, which we write as t epsilon, and we just say that t epsilon of f, which gives you another function, t epsilon of f at position x is just the expectation over y that are distributed in this fashion of f of y. So you can sort of think of this thing as sort of smoothing out the value of the function around at a given point. Okay, so it turns out that this has an equivalent definition, which is very nice in terms of its action on the Fourier coefficients. So it turns out that this noise operator applied to F just suppresses the large Fourier coefficients exponentially. So start out with F being sum of F hat S pi S, and then you get this epsilon to the size of S damping effect coming in. Okay, so this is very useful for analysis. Okay, so there's the dynamic gross Bettner inequality, which is in that state. For any function f from 0 from 1 to the n to the reals, and for any choice of norms p and q, such that q is bigger than p, then we have that the q norm of the noise operator with noise epsilon applied to f is less than or equal to the p norm of f, provided that this noise rate isn't too big. Okay, so I guess noise rate is maybe confusing, because as epsilon goes down, we apply more noise. So kind of, what's this is a bit mathematical, what's an intuition behind it?
It always holds that the p norm of f is less than or equal to the q norm of f if q is bigger than p. But this inequality is saying that if we provide enough smoothing to f, then this inequality holds in the other direction as well. So we can imagine if we completely smooth f out, then we're just left with a constant function, and then all of the norms are going to be the same. What this is saying is that if we apply like a little bit of smoothing to f, then it makes some of its norms that are close together kind of comparable. But in any case, maybe the details aren't too important. Okay, so we can, thinking about this Fourier analysis, we can, and our quantum generalization of Fourier analysis, we can immediately define a quantum version of this noise operator, which I'm going to call the noise superoperator, which is defined in exactly the same way as the classical case. And this, it turns out, has an equivalent kind of, if you like, local definition in terms of the qubit depolarizing channel. I should say that this connection is well known. For example, this paper by Julia Kempe and co-authors this year, and also papers by Halever, and I'm sure many others in previous years, that the depolarizing channel has this nice interpretation. But it's still kind of a nice thing, because it means that this well-studied kind of classical operator has a quantum generalization to something that we kind of know and love already. This noise superoperator is literally just the tensor product of n qubit depolarizing channels. Okay. So now we have this quantum definition of noise.
Like mod of S in the definition of d epsilon.
There's the Hamming weighted S. So the number of non-zero coefficients.
And that's when you take a string and the four letter.
Yes. So we have a four letter string and so let's say mod of O, 3, 1, O, 0. Right. Let's say. We have this nice kind of Fourier theoretic interpretation of depolarizing channel. So now we have this idea of noise, we can try and do something naive and generalize this classical Bonamy-Bettner and Gross-Bettner inequality to the quantum world. And it turns out that the naive generalization works immediately. When I say immediately, okay, so the proof isn't immediate, but the immediate generalization works. All we do is we change F to be a Hermitian operator on n qubits. The only slightly annoying technicality in our proof is that we have this constraint that P and Q have to be either side of 2. But this actually doesn't really matter, because in applications normally one of P or Q is 2, so it doesn't hurt you too much. So what's this inequality saying? It's saying something about the norms of what you get when you apply the depolarizing channel, qubit depolarizing channel to operators. Okay, so I guess I went running quite late, so I won't go over the proof. But the proof is different to the classical case, because if it weren't for the fact that multiplicativity of maximum output p norms were false, then the proof would be the same as the classical case, but it's not, but and it turns out we have to come up with a different proof. Okay, so I'm just going to quickly mention corollary and then go to the end. Well, and what to say what we use this for, then go to the end. So we can define the degree of an operator just in the same way that we define the degree of a function, just the maximum Hamming weight of a string where there's a non-zero Fourier coefficient. Once we come up with this definition, we have this corollary of the inequality on the previous slide, which is that if we have a Hermitian operator and that its degree is low, like say the degree is d, and imagine that d is low, then its norms are kind of close together. So imagine that q is a larger norm than 2. This inequality says that the q norm is still quite close to the 2 norm. And this might be nice because 2 norm is very easy to work with. And in particular, this corollary allows us to prove quantum Friedgott-Kallein-Auer theorem, which becomes fairly straightforward to prove in a similar way to the classical result, which I don't have time to explain. Basically, it allows us to say this, make this statement about this sort of Fourier tail of the quantum Vidian function. It says that some of the squares of the Fourier coefficients with the support bigger than 1 is less than epsilon, then f is almost epsilon close to being a dictator, so only depending on 1 qubit, or a constant, not depending on any qubits. So this is kind of the first sort of result that helps us understand the Fourier expansion of quantum Vidian functions. We don't have any real applications of it yet, but given that there are applications of the classical result to social choice theory and theory of voting, it might be very interesting to try and come up with some meaningful generalizations, something to do with quantum voting, if you like, but we don't really know what that would be yet. Okay, I'm going to cut straight to the conclusions now. Okay. So there are lots of these classical results that turn out to have quantum analogs, and hopefully some of them are kind of interesting. Unfortunately, there are still many of these classical results which don't immediately translate to the quantum world, but they leave you with very interesting conjectures. One of which I think is very nice but seems quite hard to prove is if we have a quantum Boolean function that acts non-trivially on n qubits, so operator that does something to all n qubits, does it hold that the degree of this operator has to be at least log n? This holds classically, and the proof completely fails quantumly. And I think it's very plausible this to be true. As I said, there are various property testers that we haven't quite sorted out yet, and I don't know how to analyze. Also a very interesting result we might want to prove is whether every quantum Boolean function has an influential qubit. So what does this mean? So classically, we have this definition of influence, which is, you know, how much voter I can sway the election, if you like, if you think of this thing as a voting scheme. And there's these results that say that if the function f satisfies some intuitive properties, then there has to be some voter that can sway the election more than you would like. And in the quantum case, this would translate to some qubits, and which, you know, what the state of that qubit is kind of affects the results of, affects what your quantum Boolean function does to a sort of surprising extent, if you like. That's extremely vague, but I don't have time.
Difference between qubits in their relative influence. It might just be that all the qubits are too influential.
Right. Exactly. So for example, there are classical Boolean functions where every voter is equally influential, and they're all very influential. And this is true in the quantum case as well. Like the straightforward classical function, which all voters have a lot of influence, is just a parity function, because any voter can flip the outcome just by flipping his bit.
Yeah.
But for example, I mean, what you might want if you were designing a voting scheme is you want every voter to have low influence. Like, you don't want any voter just to be able to wake up one morning and decide that they want to change the election. So like, basically the influence of a voter is the probability that the function's value is undefined if the voter hasn't voted yet.
They should choose a scheme which minimises their influence.
Yes, this is true.
You don't want a quantum dipole either, where just flip it.
That's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, if you want to start as a scheme, you're minimizing everybody else's influence.
Yes.
Or you're not everybody else's influence, but any other influence.
Okay, so this is the end. There are some references. This survey paper and this lecture course were very nice instructions to classical theory of Boolean functions. Thank you very much.
Any questions for running? Do we use them all up?
When is an inequality? I mean, so there's another hyper. Contractility. What is it? Hypercontractility?
Yes. So
inequality by Benaroya.
Yes, I should have mentioned this. So this is a different. Basically, this is a different generalization of classical hypercontractive inequality. Mm-hmm. So their generalization is it's still on functions, if you like, rather than on operators, but it's functions that. Let's say the space of d-dimensional square matrices. I probably couldn't state their exact result for you, but basically it's to do with if you have a function like this, then it's sort of looking at the norms of the resulting matrix and saying something about that. But it takes a slightly different perspective than our generalization. It doesn't go from this idea of noise. It's kind of, you could say, if you like, that it's
a generalization of a corollary of this inequality. But it's, yeah, this is just a different generalization.
It's kind of interesting, like, the proofs are completely different, but the structure of the proof is maybe similar. Like, there's every proof of this type of transfer process. I can talk about something who's interested later in the any such proof seems to have a sort of interesting double induction type structure where you use induction on the dimension and you also have some other kind of inner induction going on. But, and that's true for their proof and our proof.
So one crazy generalization you could make in a classical case is simply to think of all maps from 2 to the n Hilbert space to 2-dimensional Hilbert space.
Yes.
Which gets you into all kinds of trouble, presumably, and allows you to do all kinds of insane things with these functions. I was just wondering, is there an analogy in a classical case of some broadening of the class of Boolean functions that lets you compute things, you know, compute ridiculously uncomputable things? Or not?
I don't know. There's such a generalization. I'm certain that there are people who have thought about every wacky generalization.
Well, in the classical case, I could think of some midway point of functions taking reals to a real.
Mm-hmm. Maybe to not to a real, but to a bit of a probability distribution. Mm-hmm. So then it's still kind of Boolean because you have binary outputting, so that it's a probabilistic one, okay. Which could have a weird probability.
Any other questions? Let's thank Ashley again.